I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 183 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Sometimes while browsing albums, especially on Record Store Day, I'll come across a project featuring a newly unearthed recording, and I'll think, wow, how cool. I had that reaction this past Record Store Day when I saw that one of the offerings was a limited edition double album of previously unreleased Patsy Cline performances called Imagine That, The Lost Recordings, 1954 to 1963. This April's Record Store Day also offered previously unreleased performances on Bill Evans' Further Ahead, Live in Finland, 1964 to 1969, Freddie Hubbard's On Fire, Live from the Blue Morocco, Kenny Dorham's Blue Bossa in the Bronx, Live from the Blue Morocco, and Charles Mingus's In Argentina, the Buenos Aires concerts. Last year, after hearing Blue Note President Don Was rave about it, I picked up McCoy Tyner and Joe Henderson's Forces of Nature, Live at Slugs. That's a Blue Note release of an incendiary and, yes, previously unreleased, live performance featuring the legendary jazz pianist and saxophonist. What I didn't realize at first was that all of these releases were overseen to a large extent by someone nicknamed the Jazz Detective, Zev Feldman. He has turned his passion as a crate-digging record collector into a career. He is a sleuth who tracks down previously unreleased recordings and works with estates, musicians, and other rights holders to get them released. Often these albums come out on Resonance Records, the label of which Feldman and George Klabin are co-presidents. The packages tend to be lavish, with booklets full of photos, essays, and notes, in keeping with Feldman's goal to make every release an event. The Patsy Cline compilation came out on Feldman's new Deep Digs imprint for non-jazz releases. And as he relates in this expansive conversation, he's done much deep digging in his many years as a music lover. He discusses being influenced by Village Voice critic Robert Christgau, his time working for record labels, and the project that established him as the Jazz Detective. He also lays out in specific terms the importance of Record Store Day, how tight his margins can be, and how sometimes he must let go of a dream project if the numbers don't work. Do most of his projects originate with him searching for a recording, or someone approaching him with something rare? Does he have a white whale he's been pursuing? If you've listened to many of these episodes, you know that I love nerding out with fellow music obsessives, and Feldman is among the most knowledgeable and passionate ones around. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Zev Feldman. Were you always a crate digger in terms of records?
I think it really picked up when I got new gear. Well, I took my dad's record player around maybe 99 or so, and a giant chunk of my parents' record collection, and gave it to me. And then I really started buying more. But, you know, it's funny, it's kind of off and on through the years, because I remember periods where I wasn't buying records as much and CDs were king, but not everything was available. And I'll never forget this memory. That was so crazy. I used to read like a lot of critic review guides, most notably Robert Christgau at the Village Voice, who was a big influence on me. I mean, really what it was he very rarely gave out like an A+ or an A. So certain things, like if he gave it high marks and I'm trying to discover this artist, I would start with those records, kind of my compass. So I remember like trying to look for James Brown records before they were reissued on CD, not even understanding or grasping the concept that stuff's out of print. So I'm calling record stores, like, you know, in the mall, your Sam Goody's, right, your National Record Mart, what we had here and other place, and they didn't have it. So, like, I remember buying There It Is from James Brown on vinyl sometime in the mid-90s, perhaps it was. Might even been a little before that, actually, earlier. But, yeah, like, you know, if I wanted something and it was available, that's what I would do. But it's been a whole evolution of watching the marketplace issue recordings and things go out of print and things come back in. And I just remember those days when not everything was available. Same thing with, you know, a lot of Blue Note releases that I would go to New York to Tower Records in Greenwich Village and get these import copies of Liberation Music Orchestra or Ready for Freddie from Freddie Hubbard or Horace Silver's doing the thing live at the Village Gate. It was just such a fascination. And anyways, I feel like my life's always been in record stores because even when it was CDs, so often I was just like the center of my universe. So I love discovery. I still do. I find that certain things I'm numb to, like I feel like I've seen so many different releases over the years. But when you're collecting jazz and there's so many different potential combinations in the roux, if you will, of combining the sounds of your different favorite instrumentalists, it jazz has so many different possibilities and there's so many sessions. So I'm still discovering a lot of jazz records and
Right.
classical music too. I love classical piano, particular sonatas, not as much concertos, although that too, but I really am like a collect piano recitals. Anyways, it's all about our discovery and our journey. And for me, I was lucky because I worked in record company distribution for major companies and also on the label side. And it really accelerated my knowledge, my learning, being familiar with different catalogs, kind of taking you down a rabbit hole. But, the music and shopping and stores and digging, there's always been digging. In fact, I named my label Deep Digs
Deep
because.
Digs, right? That's your non-jazz label that you put out the Patsy Cline on.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm going to be launching a new imprint soon that I'll be announcing, and it's not going to be all jazz either. There's a lot of great music in this world to hear, and as much as I love jazz, I'm also interested in doing things that fall outside that as well. And Patsy Cline's a really great example.
I was just going to say, when you were sort of getting into the whole, deep digging thing, if one of those Christgau A Plus records was on CD, did it have the same magic, or did you really find that you wanted to find the stuff on vinyl?
No, it really had the same magic to me. It really, for my virgin ears, hearing an important recording for the first time and having a compass kind of direct me. And that's just one example. I mean, I remember the Rolling Stone record guides. When you're younger and you don't have as much disposable income, those purchases, you should do your research first.
Absolutely. And you couldn't watch it on YouTube back then either, so you listen to it.
No, but we talk about Christgau for a second. When I talk about accelerated learning, I was really discovering records, and it wasn't all jazz, but whether it would have been Miles Davis, a tribute to Jack Johnson, or the bands Before the Flood. There are certain records that like it drove me to having that research, and honestly, releases that amongst my friends and peers maybe discovered much later. I was really seeking in my teens. And I mean, and that was really a big thing for me, is just always been discovering new things. And it's like a drug. There's some sort of chemical in the brain when you hear certain things hear it for the first time or not. Anyways, there are all these different possibilities that are unlocked. And it's really just about trying different things. And I'm all about diversity and listening to, hey, man, if it turns me on, and I don't know, just go listen to things. But music has been that way and had a really important purpose and meaning in my life, like a lot of us. And I'm sure you would also attest to having, similar experiences.
Oh,
It's,
sure. That's why we're here.
yeah.
When you would fall in love with one of these albums, are you someone who is driven to, like, I need to find the OG first issue of that record with the Van Gelder, mastering pressing of it, or like, now I need to get like the new AAA Kevin Gray version of it, and because people say that one's better than the 80s one I have. Do you just buy like multiple copies of records that you love?
It's funny. So like if I'm shopping and let's say there's some record that's always been one of my favorites. If I come across an original copy or it's a chance to have it, I will confess, if it's in the price range I'm willing to pay for, I'm okay with that. But you bring up something. What a tremendous time we're living in this era of reissues and catalog mining. I will say that I've been just astounded and moved deeply by the great work of that Tone Poet series. Before I started producing records for them, there's something about going all analog. And I've mentioned this in other interviews too. There was a release of Jackie McLean's Right Now. And also, it's an album that I've primarily been listening to on CD for years and years and years. When I got that Music Matters release and had a chance, there was just something upon the first needle drop that I could tell opened it up. And even if you don't have electrostatic speakers or Marantz or something, some crazy setup, you can hear the difference. And
Sure.
I love that. But and you know what? Those are just fine by me. Those are upgrades in many ways with the Stoughton jackets and 180 gram pressing. And man, what Kevin Gray and what Joe Harley have done is just incredible. And I think I speak for all of us that they're doing God's work. And it's really, these are important records. And yeah, I collected a lot of those on CD. I remember buying the 1500 series, the imports from Japan. And as a college student, paying $30 a piece back in the early 90s.
Right. That was a lot back then.
As sure as heck was, but that's how I heard Una Mas from Kenny Durham and certain Jackie McLean records and Larry Young and other things. It's such an incredible discovery. This is, it's meaningful journeys. It's personal. Man, and don't you love talking to your friends about this? I'm doing all the talking here. I
Yeah,
should
absolutely. Well, people have heard me talk enough. It's fine. You're the focus of this. So yeah,
Thank
and I'll
you.
just chime in on any of this stuff. I mean, I had Joe Harley recently on, and Kevin Gray I've had on a few times, and yeah, those Tone Poets are fantastic. And I had Don Was on for that matter, talking about how when he realized he needed to up the game of what he was doing, he called those guys from Music Matters, and you know, they created the Tone Poets, and it's the dangerous part of it, honestly. Is that they'll put out stuff where I don't even know the music, but I'll be like, I bet this is, but I'll read the reviews, and it's so much easier to get feedback on stuff now as opposed to my old red copy of the Rolling Stone record guide with it, which is all tattered, like the original red one before they re-released it with the blue cover and the Chris Gow 70s compilation, the 80s and the 90s. So I used to do the same thing. But now you can get so many more opinions. And I still go on to Chris Gow's site, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Like more recently, I've gotten into some of those Electric Miles records. Then I'll go back and like he loves Jack Johnson and he'll start
Right.
his reviews of those. And I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. And it kind of puts it into context for me.
And look, he's not the an Ira Gittler, a Dan Morgenstern, or one of these Whitney Ballier in terms of the jazz cred, but my God, there is something to be said when a guy with such diversity in his listening gets on the soapbox and says, this one's an A plus. I remember being 18 years old and driving around in my mom's Volvo with the cassette player, listening to a Jack Johnson cassette. I bought a Tower Records on Rockville Pike for literally $3.99. Probably wasn't one of the most. Hey, stuff has been through the reissue mill already, so there's been a heightened awareness. But man, it's like having those sort of people guide you, having your friends guide you. This is also part of the culture of if you go to the right record store, conversing and getting to know the people, and it's that barbershop sort of environment, which I've always loved. Mark, like for me, I remember 25 years ago going to Joe's Record Paradise, and it's in Silver Spring, Maryland now. It used to be in Rockville, but going there on a Saturday afternoon when the owner would be there and people would be shopping and we'd be behind the counter and talking and listening to music and discussing it. I can think of very few things as enjoyable as that, and music is a big part of it. It's different. I just remember being on the bottom of the shoe and how it was always about the power of the music before I was like working in production and everything. It was just like it was something that, like all of us, something that connects with us and inspires us.
Right. I remember we used to go to Galena, Illinois, which is in the northwest corner of the state. And I remember being in a antique store with my younger daughter, who was quite a bit younger than she is now anyway. And I was kind of like going through like, you know, the crates of records that were just down in this basement, and I'm not finding anything. And I said, I turned to her, I go, so here's the thing. Chances are really good I'm not going to find anything. But if I find one thing I want, then I have a story. Then I have a story behind it, because you found it, and you found it in this weird basement in Galena, Illinois, as opposed to, you know, ordering it online or something. So for me, it's part of it, it kind of is tied to the stories. And, you know, these albums that you're releasing on, you know, Resonance, Elemental, Deep Digs, you know, they always have these beautiful books with them. And there's a lot of storytelling in terms of, you know, how you found these tapes and what the meaning of this music is and where they fit in with the artist's career. Like, how important is storytelling to, you know, appreciating and, for that matter, selling music?
Well, I've kind of adopted it into the playbook selfishly. And we first started, I take a lot of mentality of like what box set curation was years ago in the 90s, especially when stuff would come out, multiple essays being written, a lot of inspiration also from prolific writing, even if it's one main essay. Like, for instance, what Mosaic Records has done for decades. I think it's important, people, it allows us a chance to do things at a higher level. And there's always going to be the music, but I think there are these important stories to tell. And it's a selfish thing. It wasn't necessary. It's not always necessary, but I really enjoy that process. And I think that if we're going to get a chance to do a project like this, I really try to raise the bar, make it as great as it can be. Hey, is there anyone that we know that would have something to say about X musician for one of these projects, or interviewing a sideman or a club owner or somebody that's in the middle of it? And honestly, it's often about other musicians that may have been influenced too. I absolutely love that. And I like it, and it's worked, and it was something that we kind of took to a different, I wouldn't say a different level, but there's a lot of focus on it. Music first, but I want you to look at stuff. I want you to have some reading material, and I really would like for you to say, what a beautiful release, and I want you to be going back for it, taking it off your shelf years from now and spending time with it. It's supposed to be great. So it's curation. It's George Klaban at Resonance, Mark, talks to me about, he says, we are a virtual museum because what we are doing is preserving this music. So he's been in line, but I have to say, it's not a prerequisite. And it's because of everyone that's listening, that's bought one of these projects that I've had the good fortune of working on. All this is because of them. We can't do it without, at any of the labels, without there being support. And I just try to build something from my heart that I think the rest of my brethren would enjoy, and wanting to really have the right spirit about it, paying tribute, celebrating the legacies, and having important music. And I don't know, that's it. But yeah, and something too that was really meaningful to me. You know, we lost the godfather of jazz catalog, if you will, and he was so many other things, not even just jazz, but even in rock and roll music, working with Bonnie Raitt and so many other countless musicians. And but I'll never forget having a lunch with him years ago. We had just done the West Montgomery Echoes of Indiana Avenue release, which was really one of the first archival projects. And I went fucking nuts. Like, I got Pat Martino, I got Dan Morgenstern. We interviewed individuals, we had photographs, and even he said most other people might not have gone to that length, but it's fun. My days fly by.
So this was, I'm sorry, I just want to break in just so everyone knows who you're talking about. The person who we just lost, the godfather of all this.
Yeah, Michael Cascuna from Mosaic Records, and also someone that kept Blue Note Records on its charted course. There's a lot of music in the world. Anyways, coming from Michael Cascuno was something that had impact that he even reinforced and was positive about. But I think it's great. Why not? People are going to spend their hard-earned money. I really want to enhance the experience. I really want to build something. And again, it's the writing, it's the musicians who have words, it's photography, and really having some top shelf design. I personally am a little neurotic about this quality of the artwork because I know what I respond to. And I think that that's a very important part of these releases is dressing up the front of the house before you bring people in. I mean, you're kind of lost not to do it. But anyways, I'm a snob. I have opinions and I'm always pushing our crew to do the best we can. And ultimately, sometimes if things don't come together, I'm not opposed to saying, stop, let's try a new approach.
Do you think that especially now with so many people streaming music, that there's this appetite for, a beautiful, again, physical release? I'm assuming it's not a coincidence that there are these beautiful sets coming out at the same time that a lot of people are just like listening in their AirPods off of their, phones.
Well, it's a different experience. This is one of the other reasons why I really like to build something with a physical customer in mind. You only experience that when you hold it in your hand. There is something powerful, even visually, of having the record and the artwork if it's done correctly in the design. And that release right there, that Patsy Cline, John Sellards. I work with a lot of designers. John Sellards, who also did the Grammy-nominated Nat King Cole Hit in the Ramp box set, he worked on that. And we're really just being thoughtful.
In terms of like the presentation and the sales, like what's the split between vinyl and CD?
Well, it really depends on the release, and it depends on the demand. And it depends if the vinyl ships sold out. It depends on a whole variety of different matters. But listen, CD sales are not over. And I've had this conversation with a lot of people. It's another option of ingesting, pardon me for being so technical, but it's another method of people getting a piece of physical product to hold the booklet, to look at the photographs. There's something visually which is lost sometimes with digital, but digital also, that Patsy Cline record's over a million streams right now, I've been told. There's just something to be said about that. And yours truly, I stream a lot of music, especially at the gym or when I'm out on a walk or in my car. And I think I speak for so many of us, all of us, probably to a greater extent. But the CDs are, the LPs first. Let's talk about this for a minute and the importance of it. By us able to do, especially a record store day promotion, which I hold out for, it allows the vinyl to, God willing, be able to ship sold out. That is deliberate. Long tail is not for every situation, especially for live jazz or niche recordings, like a lot of us people would say is. But by doing that model, by shipping sold out, that influx resources as a result of the vinyl selling keeps the whole project sustainable. Mark, I have to spend so much of my time doing forecasting and looking at what sells. The vinyl is what has really made it happen. You like those booklets and everything we do? That's because there's a vinyl component. Because the vi it just it, there's a balance. But look, CD sales are not where they used to be, but especially for jazz and classical and this adult music, whatever you want to say, stuff that leans to a different demo sometimes. This isn't the Taylor Swift or Katy Perry audience as far as being younger skewed. A lot of those people even have records and don't listen to them. I just look at the big picture. It's really been a very positive thing over the last 15 years. And again, I'm going to say, not everything I do is Record Store Day, but Record Store Day has allowed for these incredible projects to be birthed into the world. And let me go a little bit further. I have projects that have to get the plug pulled on them because they don't get accepted. I need to find a way of making it justifiable. We live, unfortunately, when you're in business. Residence is a 501c3, little different scenario, but it's all about the numbers, and we have to be very cautious and on what we do. And if you do it right, you can keep going. And if not, it's really difficult. So we just got to be careful. But I just have so much gratitude in my heart for all the folks out there that support these releases and you having me on today to talk about it, because it can't be underestimated. This is what I really want to keep doing. I found something, it's so enjoyable, and if the people will have me as their producer, I just want to keep going. I feel like I'm campaigning some speech. But it's the truth. It's the truth, and it feels nice because we're a lot of opinionated people, and I razor sharp opinions on things. And the jazz police is a real thing, and it should be to an extent. Although if I hear one more person try to armchair stuff with me about engineering or working from a source or whatever it is, sometimes I work with the experts and I let people do that. And sometimes it can be a little frustrating too. There's a lot of opinions that are aired publicly, but we do our best and do the best job possible. And I just say, like, let's keep going. There's a lot of work
Right.
to do.
Well, having people talk about this stuff, I mean, that's one of the advantages of Record Store Day too, is that you have these forums like Steve Hoffman, where it'll go on for dozens of pages about, like, oh, what's the sound quality of the new Bill Evans? Oh, it sounds fantastic. Da 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 da. In a way that, just your average release on a Friday isn't going to get that attention. So I imagine that's part of what helps. Just that focus on it.
I think focus on releases and also publicity. I mean, we're here today because we had a publicist working projects I was involved with that connected with you. We need also folks to be able to talk about these releases publicly. And I'm not putting out a widget. I try to make these records events. And I think a lot of other producers, most of them would probably say the same thing. They're all special in their own way, but we have found a way with the community, especially with brick and mortar retail, to make all this possible. It's a complicated process. I get a migraine thinking about it because there's so much I want to do. And sometimes you just got to walk away because it just doesn't make sense financially for the company. Although sometimes at Resonance, we do things because, just to give you an example, because we are a division of a 501c3, it's always about whatever we do is always about the love. Anyways, it's interesting. I work with a variety of different companies, including my own, and there's different approaches on things. And at the end of the day, it involves resources and generosity from other people on the team who greenlight and write the checks.
What was
So,
the most painful project you had to walk away from?
well, I have a project right now which is tearing my heart out because I'm not sure if we're going to be able to sell enough to make the ju numbers justifiable. And I really hate calling things out, but I'll tell you, even I've had a lot of releases, and it's because of the kindness. But walking away, I'd have to think about that. But there have been sometimes it's an unrealistic amount of money. There was a blues guitarist that I was really a big fan of, and this one family has the tape and they wanted some absurd number like a Mercedes-Benz number. And the thing is that, these releases are very niche. They're also meant to be collectible too. We really try to do as much as possible when we determine, along with Record Store Day, when we do those releases of how many. And there's just a lot of analysis and stuff that goes in. Boy, what did I walk away from? I'd have to think about that. There seem to be too many, probably, to mention that you just have to go away. But George said to me, George Klabin, Zev, understand something. Look, the universe is going to bring you something else. It's okay to say no to a project. But for me, this isn't about a business thing. This is really about the love for an artist that I admire. So it runs deep. So we do what we can.
Right. So if like for this past Record Store Day, you had several releases, including the Patsy Cline, Bill Evans, Further Ahead. I think the Art Pepper Afternoon in Norway was not Record Store Day.
Correct. I
And
was.
is that by design, or was it sort of like you wanted it there, but that wasn't, so you just did its own release?
Correct. And we had already been way down the road on that project too, in terms of the production. But it made us stop and think that, look, unless we get accepted, that we really have to be selective about putting stuff outside of these events. That's how much I have grown to depend and rely on Record Store Day. But if we can't hit a certain number, listen, you have to pay the musicians, you got to pay publishing, you have to deal sometimes with a record company, you deal with the engineers, the designers, the photos that get licensed, different journalists that are involved. And it's staggering. It's not for the weak at heart. You know what I tell people, Mark, all the time? And sometimes, why did you make so few? You could have made more. I want to sleep at night. And I don't want to be able to stress out the people that write these checks. If we can make it work, we can be conservative and we can keep going. And it's different. Certain thresholds for different artists sell more than others. So there's a yin and a yang, and every situation is very unique to itself oftentimes. But we have to do the good fight. The music's gotta really move me. Luckily, I'm not in a position of taking on a project, because we gotta feed the bottom line for Q1 or Q2 or whatever it is. You know what I'm saying? So anyways, it's a good position, but I hold my breath. I really am. It can cause some stress, because I know if it doesn't get in, we don't find a way of hitting a certain threshold. Really, it's about hitting a certain number. How many can we sell on vinyl? Ugh, this is sounds like it's homogenized. It sounds like you're being cheap, but when you're working with other people's resources, we just got to be careful. But man, look at all the wins we've had.
Absolutely. Well,
So.
so do you print a similar number of like the Art Pepper, which is not RSD, to the Bill Evans, which is, or is it more artist related, or is it like, all right, we need to adjust our numbers because it's not getting that platform?
We had to adjust it in this case. Clearly, we had to.
Because I think people would assume that if it's not for Record Store Day, there are more of them, because it's not like you don't have to advertise limited to 1,500 or whatever. But really, you just need to press up as many as you think you're going to sell, because you don't want to be left with a full warehouse of stuff.
No, you can't. If you have what we call obsolescent inventory, you're hemorrhaging. Your project didn't make any money oftentimes. You just lost money because you decided to overmanufacture and didn't play it safe. Don't get too big for your britches. It's like, let's look at the numbers, what it takes, and see what the demand is. But understand something. We're not trying to hold back from the public. We're very scientific about this, but you have to be able to hit a certain number. You can't just open things up. Every project has different circumstances, its own profit and loss analysis, but this is real, and it's a serious thing. And we got to be really careful about, what we do. But if you have something that's left over, that's not good.
Mm.
It really means that there's a probability that maybe a project didn't even recoup. We're not in the companies, unfortunately, are not in the business to, like I said, George Clabin, we have some things that are like, you know what? That's a really important project. We're gonna do it. And you know what? Even at Elemental Music, when we did the Revelations Albert Eiler box, people are like, why'd you only make 1,200? Well, you know what? Because we needed to make sure that we could make it sustainable. And I can tell you, like, and there are a lot more examples, but that project, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, two projects with the French government, it was the generosity. I won't lie, I get rug burned sometimes from getting on my hands and knees and working with my financial folks to make sure we can have the money raised to do this. But it's a really serious thing. And if it doesn't perform, I don't know about the next one. We always have to be mindful. Anyways, it's so mundane. That's not fun, Mark.
No, well, all right, I'm going to segue from that into the jazz detective stuff, which I think is what sounds like the totally fun part of it. So we sort of got the sustainability, how you managed to do it in a part. And now we're going to go to what was like the first, your first find where you somehow came across a recording that had not been released and you were able to get it released and, you know, be something that's in the public ear that just wasn't there before.
It could very well be the West Montgomery Echoes of Indiana. Listen, technically, like the first one at Resonance, I was an associate producer on the Freddie Hubbard Pinnacle record, which started morphing into having expanded editorial and the writings and photographs. But the West Montgomery Echoes of Indiana Avenue, which I want to say was maybe 2010 or 11, that was a whole education and a really wonderful experience and journey. And also in that same window, having George Clavin's personal tapes that he made in the fall of 1968 at the top of the gate, the Village Gate's upper room in New York. And those kind of like set us on our way. You could also say the, I got a couple we got to talk about, a few. We can talk about the Bill Evans Some Other Time release, which was an unearthed studio session, a completely different set of circumstances. And also the Larry Young in Paris was an incredibly important one for me personally because of how much love I have in my heart for Larry Young and what he means to me in terms of an artist. That was of an epic find and discovery. And wasn't I lucky that that landed number one on the Rara Avaris historical archival recording chart from the late, great Francis Davis, the NPR Music Critics Poll. You could also say the Les Liaisons Don Jerusse, the 1959 studio sessions from Thelonious Monk. I could go on, and we could make cases why each of them are important in their own right. But man, it's like I look back behind me, and it's incredible what we've all been. And I say what we've all been doing because that involves the people that come out and support the releases. It can't happen without you. And obviously the musicians and their families too. There's been a lot of lessons learned and a lot of friendships that have been built and a lot of relationship building. I talk about over and over about this process because you're building a track record and you're building trust with people. And especially if people don't know you, that can be really difficult sometimes. So
are you at a point where most of the projects are people coming to you and saying, hey, look, jazz detective, I've got this amazing recording that you should hear versus you sort of hearing, hey, you know, I hear that there's this treasure trove of recordings from this club in New York from 1971, and I'm going to look into it and, you know, do my detective work and see what comes up.
It goes both ways. I'm constantly being contacted, including, you know, people that, oh, I know, you know, stuff that I'm already aware of too, and that's okay. There's a lot of enthusiasm. People reach out to me sometimes with discoveries, and sometimes it's a really real discovery. You know, we are still making incredible finds and finding ways of bringing them out all these decades later. It almost seems endless. And the good thing, I think, is that a lot of this stems from live archival recordings, which in many ways is oftentimes a more spirited, different interpretation of music, and it can be even more jaw-dropping.
So people come to you, and sometimes they come with stuff you've heard of, sometimes they come with stuff that turns out to be great, sometimes they probably come with stuff that's just bogus. Hey, I got this uncovered Paul McCartney tape. Like, yeah, it's not Paul McCartney.
Oh, yeah. Like, or the guy that brought me, oh, I've got this unissued Billie Holiday recordings. And luckily we had Phil Schaff at the time who I discussed it with. And he said, oh, no, that's been out on this release, blah, blah, blah. And it's okay. I encourage people to be communicate with me because it really can lead to some good things. People hear about stuff. There's stuff out there that we have yet to pull and might be under somebody's bed or up in somebody's attic. But we, you know, I can help vet that stuff and really determine First of all, is it really worthy of coming out in the first place? Is it adding something, a new chapter? Is there a redeeming quality in the performance itself or the artist? There's just a variety, it's a mixed bag, but there's a variety and it goes both ways. I do discovery, I do searching, but I love it. I also hear from people too, and I'm like, what? Where did this come from? So, there's been a lot of kindness in this community, in this public of jazz fans, and I feel grateful to be in this position where folks are even aware of the work that I'm involved with. And it's not just me. I'm one guy in this field. So that especially is something very rewarding, and it's kind, it's not lost on me.
I'd gotten an email originally about the Patsy Cline Imagine That release, and then realized you had done that and kind of was looking into the other, Record Store Day releases that you had for this year. And then I sort of, did a little more research and realized that you had produced the McCoy Tyner Joe Henderson Forces of Nature live at Slugs, which I knew about because I talked to Don Was, and then I bought it because I thought, wow, this sounds like really amazing. Tell me about just whether it's coming to you, they're bringing it to you, or you're seeking it out, kind of that first time you hear a recording like Forces of Nature or something else, like what your emotional reaction is to when you realize, hey, this is great.
Oh, it can just be mind-blowing, and especially because this isn't about business. This is about, does something hit us in our heart in the right place? Man, it's really great that you brought up that album. That Forces of Nature release is probably arguably one of the most exciting experiences I have, and it took upwards of 6 years to make it happen. And it made a lot of people happy, but I'll never forget being told about it and going to Jack DeJohnette's home where he played it for me. And I just remember my jaw falling to the floor. I just remember how awe-inspiring it was. And it had something that had the elements that hit me in the right place. I can't fake that. But like a lot of us who have heard that tape now, we realize how incredible it is. It really supports my point about we're still making these discoveries. And this was sitting in Jack DeJohnette's personal tape archives since it happened in 1966. Just extraordinary. But yeah, the first time I heard that, my heart probably started racing a little bit. I just remember more than anything just thinking like, wow, how amazing. And also thinking to myself, like a lot of other people too, boy, if that's how hot that was, what about some of the other shows that we haven't heard? And Slugs is a place that for a whole lot of us, it's like something in a very enchanted place in people's imagination. Folks that haven't been there, we look at these photographs, we see those incredible posters of the likes of Larry Young and Art Blakey and the Tony Williams Lifetime and Sun Ra and Hank Mobley and all these folks that came before us who today we really celebrate and are near and dear to us. And it was going down there. That was a very special thing. There were a lot of feels that were captured and just so moving. How, what did you think the first time you heard that?
I thought it was so energetic and amazing. I mean, it just popped out of the speakers and it was exciting. And I'd sort of streamed a little of it just to sort of hear it. I think that Don Was had mentioned it, and I'm just like, okay, I have to just like stop listening to this through my AirPods, and I just have to, pick it up and blast it on, my turntable. And yeah, you feel like you're in your room, in the room, in a really thrilling night. And I'm someone who I will admit, I've like come to jazz late relative to, you know, the Beatles and REM and Elvis Costello and Talking Heads and Radiohead and, you know, like that sort of thing. And I've kind of, you know, circled back to, you know, was kind of going through, you know, via kind of soul, like mid-70s, early late-60s soul and soul jazz. And I just kind of, you know, gone back. And part of it is just, you know, so I've sort of trained my ears to hear this stuff better. So by the time I heard that one, I'm like, oh yeah, that one's pretty great. Jack DeJohnette, you know, prominent, you know, in case listeners don't know, prominent jazz drummer, also piano player sometimes. He plays this for you. How does it go from him playing it to you being able to produce this record and release it on Blue Note as opposed to your own label or just not release it at all?
Wow, some things are just kismet, including the timing on how things worked out. So, one of Jack's representatives, a lawyer from overseas in Berlin named Steven Reich, introduced me to Jack, already knowing that I was really deeply immersed in this archival space. And around that same time, I got to think back on what came first. I had just started showing up on the doorstep of Blue Note Records, and it was at a point where Don, Justin Seltzer, and I were discussing what projects could we do together. And the timing of working with them at that point, and the good fortune I have even to this day, we're doing a production right now of some incredible music coming. But the point is, it worked out where I had just like found myself in this capacity. So I'm like, look, this is, and I told them, I've brought you a lot of stuff. This has got to be the most exciting, most interesting. It's got to come out. And I love it too. There's something very nice working with Don, and I'll never forget, Zev, what are you most passionate about? And we had a chance, like the passion meter on a 1 to 10 was 20 on this one. I mean, there was just no doubt. And every time going back and listening to it. So yeah, you know, it's timing and getting a chance to know certain folks. I've also had projects that I've taken to Ken Drucker at Verve Label Group too, where I might find myself involved. That could be the Thelonious Monk Palo Alto, or also the Stan Getz gets at the Gate, which I had the good fortune of being a part of, and I think I might be leaving some stuff out. But anyways, knowing who to go to, know who identifying who rights holders are. This is another thing that's, I look at a list, I don't even need to hear it sometimes. I can just identify all based on a day of a recording. Who's going to need to be dealt with? Anyways, all these steps, like I said, Mark.
Right. Yeah, well, I was wondering about like the rights holders and how complicated that would be. I mean, Patsy Cline was on, you know, numerous labels, you know, throughout her career. You know, this Imagine That, The Lost Recordings, 1954 to 1963, you know, has music from multiple sources. Like, are there like a lot of hoops you have to jump through in order to go from the we've discovered these amazing never heard Patsy Cline recordings to here they are on vinyl?
Yes, there's a lot of hoops, and there's a lot of steps, and you have to identify who controls what tracks, or are they all controlled by one source? The Patsy Cline Imagine That release, I will say, next to the Nat King Cole Hit in a Ramp Box, which was a blessing and was Grammy nominated, those two, but especially that Patsy record, had more hoops. Because forget about the fact that we contacted Universal Music Group and we have made an arrangement with them, because record labels can have blocking rights too. But we had so many different sources of individuals that were private collectors that had these recordings in their own archives, or tracking down all these different all this material that had different places, whether it was the Country Music Hall of Fame or the Grand Ole Opry, or dealing with variety folks, but most importantly, the estate. They stop and start everything. It's turnkey. If I didn't have a deal with them, forget about it. We wouldn't have been here, and I certainly wouldn't be pushing a round peg and a square one doing something without the proper clearances. But it's maddening. But we made this one happen thanks to Dylan Utz and George Hewitt, my co-producers, who knew these people out in the world that had these things. And because of that think tank, this this group of us, we were able to pull together and make it work. It's so exciting. We worked so hard, and I have to say, it's probably one of the most important projects I'll ever be involved with in my career. It's such an important, iconic figure in music. All these years since her passing, we're bringing something out officially for the first time. I think there's something to be said about that, and I think that the way the public has responded, including the press, has just been amazing, and it's reinforced that. But man, it's like I got to pinch myself, Mark. I mean, look what I'm getting a chance to be involved with. It's a very special set of circumstances, and I feel very lucky.
I mean, when you talk about dealing with the estates, I mean, you're really talking about families. Patsy Cline's daughter wrote, the first of the liner notes on this. I know you're dealing with the estates on a lot of these other, jazz artists who you work with, repeatedly. Like, what is that like, just sort of establishing these relationships with those families?
Well, it starts and stops with them. Unless you get a deal with them, you're not going anywhere. Unless it's a reissue and let's say a label owns the master and you're licensing it, perhaps. There's all sorts of different ways of broaching that.
But is that a matter of sort of just getting them to trust you, to understand, your track record and.
I'm very transparent about the process, especially never ever making any promises or guarantees. There's examples and things that we've done in the past that we can speak about, but I'm always very cautious in not over-promising. Ultimately, we just often don't know how these projects are going to perform. Here's my intention. When I do something, I mean, I've used this before. When I went to Wes Montgomery's family for the first time, Robert Montgomery, his son who runs the estate, I said, I know this is going to sound ambitious, but I want to do the most amazing package that's ever been assembled for your father before. And I echo that sentiment for other releases too. And that's the truth. We aim for that. And I keep people in the front seat with me. Oftentimes, too, because I want people to feel good about it. And it's nice. There are also folks that just trust me and know that we're going to get something. And it's really about making people happy. And like I said, and Ben, especially, look, this fall, it'll be production number 14 with the Bill Evans Estate. So the family knows me by now and knows what I stand for. And I've been lucky, and they could always get in the middle, get in there too. And but it's been an amazing experience. And we're talking about families of musicians who you idolize growing up. And this is also a very special thing too. It becomes very emotional, becomes very personal, wanting the deal to happen, feeling peaks and valleys as you're negotiating terms or you don't have a solid yes yet, and you know how that project makes you feel. I want to be the guy on top of the mountain beating my chest. Am I going to have a chance to do it and preaching my love for this artist by the design of these projects? It's in the hands of the family. And but anyways, there's all sorts of feelings in the process because I'm not just trying to do some business deal. I'm trying to do some awesome project that, as George Klabin at Resonant said to me, will live on past our lifetimes. And when I hear that, that can be a little daunting at first, but you know what? That's the reality. So anyways,
Right.
it's an exciting process, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. I want to keep going as long as I can, and my days fly by and I have such enjoyment from it. And again, it all comes down to your listeners and people that support these releases. And I just, encourage anyone, stay in touch. I'm on Instagram at feldman.zev. I'm also on Facebook. I'm even on LinkedIn. And I'm shameless. I always use those avenues as a way to keep in touch with the fans, to let them know what I'm working on, and including even reviews and stuff. So anyways, we're all in this together. I just say, as I like to say time and time again, let's keep going. There's more for us to do, and I can't do it without everybody out there. And it just, thank you so much.
How far ahead are you working? Like what, do you have like next year's slate already ready to go?
Yeah, I'm actually working on November releases right now. And then I'm also working on next April's releases.
So we're talking about Black Friday, RSD Black Friday, and then next year's Record Store Day.
Yes, sir. That is, we're really far out in advance, but we have to be, because there's also dealings that have to happen with all these different entities that we work with. So we work pretty far out. And sometimes some projects come together rather quickly, more than others. And some can drag on and on. I've had some that take upwards of 6 years. Jaco Pastorius, Thad Jones, Mel Lewis, All My Yesterdays, as an example. But it's amazing. I wouldn't want to do anything else.
You can't preview any of that stuff, I assume.
Not at this time. And besides, I want to surprise everybody. You get one real chance to whack people over the head and make that impression. You know what? It can be diluted if you keep it out there for too long. And there's something to be said about, I tell people, man, unveiling day, even with social media, putting that album cover up in the feed and giving people that information. Man, it's so much fun. It's great.
Is there such a thing as a white whale for you, like that the fabled recording of something that you either know exists and you haven't been able to get, or you don't know if it exists, but if it does exist, like the full cut of the Magnificent Ambersons, you want to get your hands on it, ears on it?
I'll give you two, and I get asked this a lot. I think first, man, if I've had a nickel for every person that's written to me with some theory behind where the West Montgomery John Coltrane Monterey performance is, I'd be a very wealthy guy. And I've heard so much speculation, and it's crazy. That would be really cool to find that. There's also recordings that supposedly exist out there of John Coltrane and organist pianist Larry Young, which I've been looking for years, and I have some leads. And then another interesting one that came into the mix a few years ago already, drummer Joe Chambers told me that he contacted me several years ago and asked me, you got to find the family of recording engineer Orville O'Brien. That's the guy that did. He recorded Forces of Nature with Joe and McCoy. He recorded The Free Slave from Roy Brooks on Muse. He recorded Friends and Neighbors from Ornette Coleman. And this guy had a portable setup and would go and record shows just like he did for Jack DeJohnette. Well, apparently, as Joe Chambers told me, there was a rehearsal concert for Eric Dolphy's Out to Lunch that was somewhere, I believe it was at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It had a different name back then. Somebody out there will know right away. But apparently, that gig didn't have Tony and it had Joe on drums. And it was a rehearsal gig. Can you imagine finding that music live? I haven't given up. But those are a couple, just a few rather, of my white whales that I would love to find.
All
And I'm
right.
constantly being surprised on other things that come into the atmosphere. It's incredible.
All right, anyone out there, you have to help find these white whales for Zev and for us, because we'll all get to listen to
And before you start making random
them.
phone calls and try reach out to me, and maybe I could explain something. But this is really a team effort, and it happens with a lot of people out there in this community of ours. So,
All right, and I'm going to ask you now one, and then I'll let you go. But I'm going to ask you one that you've probably been asked a million times. But for the record, so what was the first time you were called Jazz Detective?
First, Robert Baird at Stereophile magazine wrote a profile on me, and he called me the Indiana Jones of jazz. And then somebody used Jazz Detective, and I can't remember. I have to think back on that, and it stuck. Listen, we're lucky in this life, especially for something so wonderful like curating music, but people even know who you are. I'm very grateful to have made some impression. I'm more than just a jazz detective, but hey, it's a kind thing, and I'll take it happily. And just it's a nice thing to be at the service of the people.
Right. Well, no, and hey, Patsy Cline, you're clearly like the multi-genre detective now.
Yeah, I've had some other stuff that I've done too. I produced on CD a series of Norman Whitfield Temptations reissues for Motown, also with Elemental. I did the Sister Rosetta Tharpe release, which was a 1966 solo guitar concert from Limoges, France. I like doing things outside of jazz, and I enjoy jazz music too, but there's a lot of food groups and different stuff to listen to, and there's so much wonderful music out there. But I choose to champion the recordings that get me most excited and I'm proud about. So, like Patsy is an example. It's like, oh my gosh, so important, so important. I mean, I wanted to run towards it and not walk. Like, I wanted to raise my hand at the first opportunity. I'm very glad and grateful that I did. And again, I'm grateful to Carlos Augustin Callenbert, who is my CFO and the general manager of Elemental. It took a leap of faith and generosity to say, okay, I'm going to listen to this producer. It worked out. We've had some releases that haven't done always as well too, and I will say that there's leftover vinyl for Cal Jader and also for Sister Rosetta, and on Resonance there's some Les McCann available, and there's also some still some Al Jarreau. There's stuff that doesn't always, it's hard. I'm getting really into nitty gritty, but I think about this formula that we've discussed earlier today and in throughout this conversation.
I was gonna say that Patsy, I think you got to pay like $100 for it now if you want to get it on Discogs.
I've
So,
seen it. I've seen it for 200.
what was your involvement with Mamma Mia?
I worked for Universal Music and Video Distribution, UMG, from 1999 to 2005. And I was involved with the sales and marketing. I was out in the field when we put out that release. And it was at the time, I think it says it's gold, but it's probably sold way beyond that. But you know what happens is they don't do this as much in the music business. When a record would, pr I worked in distribution, so we had tons of different labels. The point is, when you work for the company and you have these projects and at least in the past, when they would perform well, it would be a token sort of thanks that the label would do. And that was back in a different time, too, when CDs were booming and there was this infrastructure of in all the major cities, record company branches and distribution.
Absolutely. I used to deal with them at the Chicago Tribune. Your local reps, for Warner Brothers and everything else.
Probably knew, yeah, I could drop some names on you. That you probably know, but yeah, and I just feel glad to still be in the game. It's been an evolution. The first 14 years of my career were done in sales and marketing, not in this area, Mark. So it's I'm very fortunate to do this, and I feel like it's kind of given me new life, a different part of my career, and I'm very happy, and it's a difficult business these days, as I think that you would attest. It's very hard, but like I said, I just want us to keep going. I want to keep doing stuff. I want to have fun. I really enjoy what I do more than anything.
Well, you put out a lot of really cool stuff, so
Thank you.
I'm, and it's a pleasure for me to talk to you and also to make those connections that it's like, wait, you're the Forces of Nature guy and the Bill Evans guy and the Patsy Cline guy and all this other stuff. And and if and I guess if you want things to go full circle, you'll have some ABBA, undiscovered, the ABBA, the lost recordings or something, and that'll seal the, that'll complete the circle.
That would be interesting, but I think I would be probably much more fulfilled finding some incredible concert recital of Svyatoslav Richter or Maurizio Pollini or Martha Argerich or Claudio Arrau. I worked also at Polygram and Universal, where we had the Rolls Royce of classical music too. I really love classical music. I love a lot. Anyways, but yeah, you never know about ABBA. That could be interesting, right?
There you
So,
go.
anyways, you never know.
Yeah, great talking with you. I'm just
Thank
like.
you. It's been a really blessing, this career of mine. I've got a chance to experience a lot of different stuff, but the people are a really big part in the artists. Gil Shahama was there too. I'm trying Bryn Terfel, all these guys, a lot of different artists. Anyways, I love talking about other music too,
Yeah, no, but and honestly, I've just there have been several of these I do where I'm just very inspired by talking to people who have figured out how to turn their passion into a career, because that's hard to do. So, mazel tov.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That's all for episode 183 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Zev Feldman for sharing his passions, adventures, and insights as the jazz detective who also releases Patsy Cline albums and music from other genres. Recent releases on Feldman's Resonance label, on CD, as well as limited edition vinyl, include Art Pepper's An Afternoon in Norway, the Kongsberg Concert, Bill Evans' Further Ahead, Live in Finland, 1964 to 1969, Freddie Hubbard's On Fire, Live from the Blue Morocco, Kenny Dorham's Blue Bossa in the Bronx, Live from the Blue Morocco, Charles Mingus's In Argentina, the Buenos Aires Concerts, and Patsy Cline's Imagine That, the Lost Recordings, 1954 to 1963. Go to resonancerecords.org to shop the catalog. McCoy Tyner and Joe Henderson's Forces of Nature live at Slugs can be found on Blue Note. You can follow Feldman.Zev on Instagram, and he also has a public Facebook page. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, a musical sleuth who always gets his band. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.